Welcome to The Point Home Services, the podcast where real contractors share real strategies. We cut through the noise and get straight to the point with the contractors that are working in the field right now. If you run a home services business and want to lead better, grow faster, and stay sharp, you're in the right place. Now, before we get started, I need you to do one thing. Only 30% of our listeners are following the show, so stop what you're doing, hit follow, and let's get to the point.
This is To The Point, a Rhino Experience, voted one of the top home services marketing and operations podcasts, cutting through the bullshit and getting to the point.
Rhino X, let's go ahead and give a nice warm welcome to Mr. Michael Franzese.
Everybody having a good time? All right. So on this video, thank you for coming, and I've spent a lot of time listening to the podcast and everything I could find on the web. You've got an incredible, interesting story. So
thank you.
I appreciate you being here. I did notice, though, that when I was researching, that your father was in the same business.
I guess you can call it that, all right?
And did you work with your father when you were a kid?
Well, no, actually, my dad was the underboss of the family, second in command, the Colombo family. And originally, he didn't want this life for me. He wanted me to go to school, be a doctor, stay off the street, get an education. And I was on that road. I was actually a pre-med student at Hofstra University on Long Island when my dad drew a 50-year prison sentence. And it was life-changing for me at that point.
So I'm going to do a little left turn because I got this question. First of all, I believe that you're an authentic, you were an authentic member of the mafia. I believe that. Now, my question. So I'm from Las Vegas, native Las Vegan. And so Las Vegas gets a lot of fruits and nuts that come in and out of Vegas from time to time. And so in business, you know, you run across people, especially the New Yorkers. Seems to me that a lot of New Yorkers come and they like to put on airs or infer that they too are mobsters in some way. Here's a particular story. I had some rental properties in Vegas, and when the medical marijuana thing law passed, I happened to have the right buildings for that. So I had, I don't know, 7 or 8 tenants like this. We had a Russian guy from Brighton Beach, and he comes in. And every negotiation he had, he wanted to throw out his inferences that he was connected, he was a mobster, he was this, and blah, blah, blah. And so, I don't know, I let it go on for a few days. And then finally I said, look, here's the way I see it. If you're a mob, if you're in the mob, you ain't talking about being in the mob. So please stop that nonsense. Let's get down to business. If you don't want the space, don't take the space. Move on. Now, did I handle it right? Are there people that are in the mob that want to infer they're in the mob? Or is that a rule that is you don't talk?
Well, let me say this. I mean, first of all, you know, the Russians from Brighton Beach, I had 3 Russian partners when I was in the gas business. And quite honestly, they were the best partners I ever had on the street. They were honorable. They were reliable. They worked like crazy, made a lot of money with them. But, you know, New York is kind of the stronghold of that life in America. And a lot of guys that come from the neighborhoods in Brooklyn and Queens and around that, they're around guys. So they try to put on the air that they're about something or they have connections. One of the things I hated the most in my life, when somebody said to me, do you know who I am? Immediately when you hear something like that, it's a turnoff. Guys in our life are not supposed to advertise who we are. You know, there's the way you carry yourself, the way you handle yourself, that's enough. But look, there's all kinds of guys out there. You know, there's guys that, you know, they wear it on their sleeve and they want everybody to know who they are. And that's normally problematic. You know, you don't do that. So, yeah, it's quite possible that somebody was trying to put an air on. But what does that mean? Are you going to do business with them? Is something going to happen even better? What are they trying to relay to you? What does it mean? So it's really silly when people do that. You know, there's no reason to do that. You know, but is it possible that they might have some kind of connection? Yeah, but if they were Russian, they certainly weren't made guys. You can't be made unless your father is Italian. So if they're Russian, they might have been connected in some way. Maybe they had a relationship, but bottom line, I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay.
It's a long way of saying that.
That's what I thought. Well, thank you. It's been a burning question. I can go to sleep at night. Okay, so can you kind of give us the origin story here? You know, your rise to running the you know, one of the most profitable enterprises of all times, really, in that world. Kind of just give us the high points.
Yeah. Well, you know, like I said, I was a pre-med student, and my dad, who was an extremely high-profile figure, he was kind of like the John Gotti of his day. He was always under investigation. My dad, during my lifetime, was tried, went to trial 3 times on state cases, twice for grand larceny, once for murder. He constantly had law enforcement around him. From the time I was 5 or 6 years old, law enforcement tactics back then were very different than they are today. There is very covert, undercover informants, high-tech surveillance equipment. Today, you can be under investigation, not really know about it until it's too late. Back in my day, when you were under investigation, they wanted you to know about it. And for a period of about 10, 12 years, when I was a kid growing up, Brooklyn, later on Long Island, my dad's under investigation from 7 or 8 different agencies. And they all had a car parked around our house 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whenever we would leave as a family, I was one of 7 kids. We had a parade of law enforcement vehicles following us. So I grew up hating the government, hated police, hated law enforcement, because I loved my dad. And I always saw them as harassing him. You know, he's in and out of jail, he's going on trial, a lot of stuff. So, but my dad kept me out of it. Go to school, son, you don't need this life. He tried to keep me in the right direction. But then he goes to trial for allegedly masterminding a nationwide string of bank robberies. It was his first federal case. He gets convicted and gets the longest sentence ever for a bank robbery conspiracy case at that point, 50 years. So he goes into prison. He's 50 years old. I'm 19. I said, Dad, you know, you're never going to come out alive. So long story short, Joe Colombo, who was the boss of our family, he kind of took me under his wing. I was very close to the family. I started meeting a lot of more of my dad's friends, talking to me differently. Mike, if you don't help your father out, he's going to die in prison. So I'm very influenced by that. I go to see my dad in Leavenworth. And, you know, I had a conversation with him. I said, Dad, bank robbery, it doesn't sound right. My father looked me in the eye and he said, Son, I'm no bank robber. I was framed on this case. And we got to help prove my innocence. And I'll tell you this, I went to jail for a crime that I was guilty of, pled guilty, did my time. And my dad did a lot of bad things in his life, you know, no question about that. But that particular crime that he did all that time for, my dad was innocent of. And I'll take that to my grave. Investigated that case. We spoke to every witness that testified against him, recanted their testimony. We gave them lie detector tests, proved they lied at the trial, but we can never get the conviction overturned. So when he told me that, I said, well, Dad, I'm not going to school anymore. If I don't help you out, you're going to die in here. We had a long conversation. He was upset about it. We went back and forth, but I was a pretty headstrong kid, and he knew my mind was made up. And he said, okay, son, but if you're going to be on the street, I need you on the street the right way. In his mind, the right way was to become a member of his life. So it was at that point in time that he proposed me for membership, because you can't just go up to somebody and say, I'd like to join. What do I have to do? Somebody has to propose you, vouch for you, say you have what it takes. In my case, it was my dad. And that's how the process started for me. I was 20 years old when he did that, and the process begins.
So I grabbed a question here. So the process of being recommended, they have to vouch for you, your ability to be able to handle the job?
Yes. And there's a lot of nepotism in that life. A lot of fathers bring their sons in, or their, you know, nephews, cousins, whatever. Obviously, for security reasons, they feel if you're part of the family, You're never going to betray the oath that you take and all of that.
And what, you know, in the video you talked about not, unfortunately, many of the guys were not earners. So what
not
was
earners?
It?
Yeah.
In the video it said earners, but so what was the percentage of earners to, what would you call the other side?
In New York, there were really 9 recognized mafia. I hate to use the word mafia for some reason. I don't know why. It's Cosa Nostra in this country. It means this thing of ours. There are 9 families that are recognized. And the way you get recognized is by having a voice on the commission. And in New York, which is the stronghold of that life, we have 5 families in New York. And our family, I was part of the Colombo family. And we had 115 made guys that actually took the oath. Out of the 115, I would say 20 of us were really earners and bringing money into the family. So you kind of had a division. You had the racketeers, which were the guys that were earning and bringing money in. And then you had the gangsters, which were trying to scrape out a living. Who's got a, you know, gambling operation? Who's got a no-show job? Whatever. And that's kind of the division. And the gangsters, for some reason, they just didn't know how to use that life to benefit them. So they couldn't become racketeers, at least most of them. But if you're a racketeer, you have to be both, because you're going to get called upon to do things that you have to do. So that was kind of the division. And, you know, we one of the smaller families, the Genovese and the Gambino families, they each had about 225, 250 guys. And I used to ask my boss, I said, how come? He said, well, we like quality over quantity. I don't know about that, but anyway, that was his excuse.
You know, it's interesting because I think our ratio is about the same, earners to workers, right? It's about the same.
Well, we didn't mean to disparage anybody at that point, too.
Okay, so you have your conversation with your dad, and you know you're going to live the life. Tell us about how you got into the gasoline business and this billion-dollar business.
Well, cut to, I go, you know, 2.5 years as a recruit, proving myself, you know, worthy to become a member. And then on Halloween night, 1975, is when myself and 5 other gentlemen, we took the oath and became sworn, made members of the...
Let me jump in. Is Halloween like a normal time or just happened to be that?
No, it just happened to be a secure night. Everybody's trick-or-treating and we were doing our thing. Because, you know, you want it to be secure, so make sure nobody's following us. We always had a lot of heat. So I was 24 years old at that point, and then I started my journey in that life. And, you know, I have to say I was fortunate. I knew how to use the life to benefit me in business, and I was very aggressive, very determined. I had 2 goals coming into that life. One, get my father out of prison. I did get him out after 10 years. Unfortunately, he kept going back on parole violations. So my dad ended up doing a total of 40 years on that 50. He was in and out 5 times. Each time he got violated, it was for association with other felons and just couldn't keep him out. So he ended up doing 40 years. And then I started, you know, just seeing how I can use that life to benefit me and got into a couple of different things, brought some new things into the family. I also had legitimate business. I mean, I had 2 car agencies. I had a big production company in California. I had a leasing company. So I was kind of entrepreneurish in that way.
And you didn't have to kick anything on your personal businesses to the cause?
If you have legitimate business that you yourself put together, you don't kick anything back.
Okay.
But anything on the street, you're obligated to give back to the family. And you kind of work out that formula. The formula that I had with my dad, anything that was on the street, I'd give the family 25%. And that worked.
Even the billion-dollar deal?
Yes.
Even the gas deal?
Yes.
Wow. Good job. Okay, so you're out earning. You got made on Halloween. You got earning, and then how'd you find this gasoline thing?
In home services, speed to lead is everything. Chirp stands out by transforming your communication strategy. With Chirp, accelerate your lead response time with instant SMS text messaging, email, and ringless voicemail automation. Chirp's cutting-edge technology ensures you're the first and the most persistent, helping you close more deals than ever. But that's not all. Say goodbye to missed opportunities with Chirp's incredible follow-up system. Keep your leads engaged and moving smoothly through your sales funnel without lifting a finger. And with Chirp deep integrations with top CRMs like ServiceTitan, HouseCall Pro, and Jobber, you can launch laser-targeted campaigns to connect with the exact right leads at the exact right time. Automation creates efficiency. Efficiency unlocks scalability. With Chirp, you can automate speed to lead, estimate follow-ups, rehash, abandoned call follow-ups, canceled job follow-ups, review requests, outbounding to your list, annual reminders, membership expiration follow-ups, and so much more. So stop chasing leads. Capture them. Connect faster and close more deals with Chirp. Contact Chirp today and elevate your communication game.
Well, it was kind of by accident, honestly. There was a guy that in the gas business, and he had a small operation out in Suffolk County. And he came to me for help because some people were trying to extort him. Some guys from another family were trying to extort him. I was kind of the guy on Long Island. So he came to me, and he asked me for help. And he told me what was going on. And initially, I didn't want to bother with him because I had heard that he had testified in a case, a civil case, against the governor at that time, the governor's brother, Hugh Carey. So when you kind of hear that, you say, maybe this is not somebody I should be involved with. And I kept turning him down. But he was very persistent. And then he came to me one day and he said, listen, I have a way to defraud the government out of tax on every gallon of gasoline, but I need your help. And so he got my attention. I don't like the government, right? I said, well, explain it to me. And so he kind of gives me this germ of an idea. And I said, okay, I'm gonna take a shot with this. So I got rid of the two guys that were bothering him. I made them go away. I didn't get rid of them, but I made them leave. And we went into business. So we opened up a company. I said, look, I don't want to be involved in your company. I don't know if you owe taxes or whatever. So let's start something new. We start a new company and we get a different office. And so I have a guy around me who is a butcher. A big guy, big scar across his head. He was kind of a forbidding looking guy. So I said, Vinny, his name was Vinny. I said, Vinny, I'm going to put you with Larry. I want you to watch him. The guy's name was Larry. And Larry, by the way, was 6'4", 450 pounds. Big guy, right? So I said, I'm going to put you with him. Let's see if he's really got something here. So I lived out in Long Island back then, and about 2 weeks later, Vinny knocks on my door on a Saturday morning. Now, he used to bring me meat on a Saturday. He was a butcher. So he comes in, and he's got a box on his shoulder. And I said, what are we having, a party here? I said, I don't know about it. What are we doing with all this meat? He says, hey, boss, it ain't meat. Come into the kitchen. So we go in the kitchen. He puts it down on the table, and he said, this is the first 2 weeks' take in the gas business. And it was $320,000. So he got my attention, really. And make a very long story short, and certainly we can go into it, but over the course of the next 8 years, we built that into, we were selling half a billion gallons of gas a month, taking down 20 to 40 cents a gallon because that was the tax at that time. It was 9 cents federal and then about 30 cents state, local, and all that other stuff. So about 40 cents. And we gave whatever the market would bear, 20 cents, 30 cents, whatever it would be. So I ended up having about 300 gas stations I either controlled or owned at that time. And then I had 18 Panamanian companies that were licensed to collect the tax on the gasoline because we were wholesalers. And we built it up into, we were bringing in $8, $9, $10 million a week at one point. Yeah. You saved my life. That means a lot. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
So you ran gas stations.
We had a number of gas stations, yes.
And then were you wholesaling the gas too?
What happened at the time, you know, it was funny. At one point in time, the FBI had went to, we were buying gas from all the major oil companies. We were buying barges that came over. We buy it whatever way we can get it. And at one point in time, the FBI had went to Shell Oil. I had bought a terminal from British Petroleum. And so they went there and they were telling, you know, you're dealing with the mob and all of that. And they said, okay, well, watch out for it. But they didn't care because we were buying the gas for them. We were actually selling it back to some of their own stations. Because we'd go into a gas station and say, how much are you paying for a gallon of gas? And they said, well, a dollar. Well, how would you like to pay 90 cents? Well, 10 cents a gallon is a lot. So they said, sure. I said, how many loads are you getting from Mobil? Let's say it was Mobil. He said, we're getting six a week. I said, well, buy four from them, buy two from us. We'll bring it to you in the middle of the night. Nobody will know the difference. Before you knew it, they're trying to buy all of it from us. We wouldn't let that happen, right? But so even though the major oil companies knew what we were doing, we were buying it from them, selling back to their station. They weren't losing anything. We were actually increasing business. So they told the FBI, yeah, we're going to watch out for it. And then it was business as usual.
Yeah. So how did you defer the, how did you not pay the tax? How'd you get away with that?
Well, it was a pretty sophisticated scheme that we had. So I can't lay it all out because I don't, in case I ever decide to go back, I don't want any competition, but... You know how many people have come to me and say, Michael, you don't have to do anything. We'll do everything. Just tell us how you do it. And I say, yeah, until you get in trouble, then it's me. But it was a pretty sophisticated scheme. But we realized that we can hold the government off for about 10 months. And it was really a daisy chain. We had 18 different companies. So after the 10th, 11th month, they would come down to the office and we would just close up, move to another part of town. We'd close that license and open another one. And just start all over again. And they really couldn't keep up with us. They had no idea what we were doing.
Wow, interesting. So did you have any even perspective of how much money would be in this thing? I mean, the $350,000 was a nice indicator, but it's not $10 million a week.
I had a vision as to how far we can go. It was all about getting the licenses. And people, I'll be honest with you, I had, you know, a politician that got us the licenses. We were paying him in New York. And I said, I can keep this going as long as I can keep the licenses going and nothing happens that, you know, somebody becomes an informant or something like that. So we ran it for almost 8 years. And what happened in the end, my partner, who originally came to me with the deal, he got himself in trouble on an unrelated matter and he became the informant. And since he created the scheme along with me, that was the downfall.
So let's get back to the ratio of earners versus what was the word you used? Not earners. What did you call it?
Racketeers.
Racketeers versus gangsters. Okay, and we have a similar condition. So, did you build your business with gangsters or racketeers a combination, or did you go after only racketeers? Like me personally, I like racketeers as opposed to gangsters.
Well, I kept the gangsters out of the business. You know, I had my own crew of guys and people that I engaged. And, you know, they were workers. You know, look, you know, I found out something in business that has really worked for me. A lot of people have said that I'm a brilliant businessman because I had a lot of things going. And I'm the first one to say I'm not. I'm not a brilliant businessman because there's many things I don't like to do and I won't do well. I just don't do it right. So my motto is always do what you do best and delegate the rest and then motivate the people that you hire and get the most out of them. And, you know, if somebody says, Michael, what's your secret to success? I would say it would be two things. Number one, I was able to recognize a good opportunity because a lot of things come across your plate when you're in action in that life. I was able to recognize a good opportunity, hire the right people, and get them to work for me. And that's it. And until this very moment, that's my secret. I have a lot of young guys around me, you know, that are on my team. I couldn't even begin to do what they do. Social media and all this marketing stuff, digital marketing. I can't even think about it. It's too complex for me. But I got the best people around me working very hard. And that's why we've been able to build what I've built now.
So interesting. So they're not working out of fear. Sounds like they weren't working out of fear. Like if they don't do it, you know, they're going to sleep with the fishes or whatever. But
I mean, that's inferred, you know, it's implied, you know.
So would you still have to motivate them and, you know, create a culture inside the business to get them to produce? Or?
Absolutely. You know, I'll tell you a story. When I got with the Russians, they had a place called Gas Stop was their brand. And they had a couple of stations in Brooklyn. And they got in touch with me because they were trying to collect money off for an account and they couldn't collect it. So we got together and we collected the money for them. And then I said, I want to go into partners with you guys. You want to do what I'm doing, but you can't get licensed and you don't understand how. Right. I said, so let's cut a deal. Okay. There was three of them. So the one guy, he's passed on now, I can tell. His name was Mike Markowitz. I said, Mike, here's the deal. You're going to buy off of my licenses and we're going to split it 75% me, 25% you. So he looked at me, he says, oh, Mr. Michael, call me Mr. Michael. He said, I don't think that's fair. I said, no, that's very fair. He said, why? I said, we're on the street. You're going to steal from me a little bit. I said, don't let me catch you, but you're going to do it. I know that. At least I can sleep at night saying I got the upper hand. I got 75%. So he looked at me and he kind of shook his head and he went back and spoke to his other two partners and he come back and he shook my hand. He says, you got a deal. So, you know, and that's the way the street works sometimes, you know, and what I said, and I'll give you an example. I knew that they were making money on the side, but they were bringing me money every single week. It was a criminal enterprise, basically. We're taking money from the government. So what am I going to complain if they're making a few bucks more? You got to know how to handle people. And I'll tell you the difference. I go away to jail in 1985, and the way it works on the street, I had to turn that operation over to the family. And I told my Russians, we got along great. They were great guys. And I told them, I said, listen, this is how this goes. You're going to have to deal with somebody else now. No, Mr. Michael, we only deal with you. I said, I'm going to jail. You have to deal with them. Well, we don't want to. No, you don't understand. You have to. There's no, okay. And I told my guys, you know, I don't want to mention any names. And I said, look, and this was my boss. I said, these are men. They're not pushovers. You got to treat them like men and you'll get plenty. And don't worry if they're taking a little bit on the side. It's okay. They're going to bring you money every week. Well, within 3 months, they blew the whole operation. Because they really tried to bully these guys. They didn't accept it. And the whole thing blew up. So, you know, it's also knowing how to manage people, knowing how to treat people. I mean, that's what's worked for me. I mean, I don't have all the answers. But, you know, everybody has their way of doing business. You said something inside. I don't even think you realize it. That, you know, you did and your daughter did. Which anytime anybody came to me with a business proposition, I said, well, show me your plan. Guy wants to open a restaurant. Well, I'm going to open up a restaurant. Okay, what's your plan? Well, I'm going to sell good food. Well, that's what we expect. But what's your plan? Didn't have one. I tell everybody, make a written plan, write it down, go over it, make it the best possible version of what what it can be, and then follow it. Now, obviously, sometimes things happen in the marketplace and things change, but at least you have a direction that you're going in well thought out from day one. And so many people don't do that. And until this moment, when I get involved in something, and now it's a lot less than what I did before, I try to really come up with a plan. And you said you did that, turned out successful. Your daughter did that at a young age, turned out successful. I think it's paramount in business that you do that.
Yeah, I agree. I always say failing to plan is planning to fail.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the Racketeers a second. Great, great lines, by the way. How is it you identify the talented Racketeers, the most talented, the ones that work best with you? Well, how did you get that?
By now, you've probably heard how much of a proponent I am for BlueOn, but I'm not the only one. When you talk to service managers using BlueOn, the stories all sound very familiar. Nick Christensen over at Herbal Heating says his team saved 46 hours in just the first month. Between the parts lookup, wiring diagrams, and AI troubleshooting, his techs are solving issues faster and ordering the right part the first time. It's even streamlined communications between the techs and the parts department. They just screenshot over the right part from BlueOn and send it over. It's simple, it's accurate, and it works. And yeah, Peterman Brothers is definitely seeing that impact too. Do yourself a favor, click the link in the description and book a quick demo to see it in action.
Well, is going to sound crazy, but when you're a made guy and you're part of that life, you don't really want to deal with other made guys. You don't want to. You want to have your own crew, do your own thing, because it's very difficult to deal with another guy that's your equal. I'll give you an example. You know, everything in our life was resolved by a sit down. You know, you had a business proposition, sit down. God forbid somebody got in trouble, you're trying to help him out, save him, sit down. We had rules at the sit down. They're actually very effective. Two made guys sitting down, one guy could be lying through his teeth. If I call that guy a liar, I automatically lose the argument because you can't be disrespectful. So you have to learn how to get your point across without bullying somebody or being disrespectful and trying to win an argument. Then you got to deal with the politics of that situation. Is this guy better connected to the boss than I am? There's a lot you have to deal with. So you learn how, in those situations, how to handle yourself. It's very good. If you can't negotiate in that life, you can't get ahead. You can't be a racketeer if you don't know how to negotiate, because everything is a negotiation, everything. So you have to master certain skills. You know, John Gotti, I'm sure everybody knows who John is. We were friends. Great guy to be around, having a drink, a lot of fun. But if you had to deal with him in a business, he was an absolute nightmare because he can never lose. He was very narcissistic in that way. He wasn't really a business guy. So if you're sitting down and you have an issue, and I had three issues with him, you have to figure out how to win the argument, but walk out of there letting him think he won the argument. And you gotta master those things, because guys on the street are very hard to deal with. Very, very hard to deal with. And so I don't know what my point was in all of this, but, you know, so you don't want to deal with them if you don't have to. You'd rather get guys that you don't have to deal with any of that, the guys you can control, you know, and just do your business properly.
So does a racketeer have to be a made man? Could a racketeer be a not made man?
Well, you had associates that were business-minded people that you dealt with. Yeah, I had a lot of those, but in that life, yeah, if you're a made guy and you're in the category of racketeer and you don't wear a name label, they just, you know, you are who you are, then yes, you have to be a made guy. And like I said, it's difficult to navigate with those guys.
We got a few in our businesses. Okay, so let's open up for some questions. Do we have some questions? Do we have a mic and all that stuff?
Yeah, and I want to relax. You can ask me anything that you want. I've been asked everything under the sun. You won't offend me. And if I don't want to answer, I know how to take the fifth. I've done that many times in my life. So, yeah.
How about Kevin over there?
I'm going to tell you two things happened with Trump. His attorney was Roy Cohen. Everybody knows who Roy is. And Roy had tried to represent me on a big case that I had, but he was actually looking to swindle me, because he said he was able to squash an indictment that was out against me. And if I gave him $250,000, he would do that. So I said, Roy, I'll tell you what. I'll give you $500,000. I'll put it in escrow. I said, it'll cost me a lot more if I have to defend myself. Take it all. He said, Michael, we don't work that way. I said, I know you don't. I said, you take the $250,000 and then something will happen and you couldn't do it. But anyway, he also represented Trump. So I met Trump with Roy on one occasion, and it was nothing spectacular. We were in a private club. I went to meet Roy. Trump happened to be there. Cut to, Russian partner and I bought two condos in Trump Towers right after it was built. And we paid a couple of million bucks in cash. Well, during the Mueller investigation, the FBI came to me and wanted to know about this situation. I said, that happened in 1982 or 1983. And I said, wait a second, because my partner was Russian and his brother, I think, was a KGB, are you trying to make the Russian connection going back 40 years ago? And they actually were. And I said, I'll tell you what, I want to tell the whole story. Bring me in front of the Mueller investigation. I want to testify there. Well, when they see me so willing to do that, they said, no, it's okay. We'll take a pass on it. But That's how far they stretch. But no, I mean, I don't really know Donald personally. I know a lot of the people around him pretty well. I just sat down with Roger Stone and Vivek, and Larry Trump is going to be on my podcast next week, I believe. So I'm circling the wagons to get to him. You know what? Here's something. I applied. I found out that he's now allowing podcasters to be in his media room. So I applied, and I'm trying to sneak my way up there through some connections that I have. I want to be in that room. Trust me. But we'll see what happens. Yes. Well, I didn't have financial statements in that regard, but you want to work for me? You know, look, and I mean, my indictment was they accused me of defrauding the government of $2 billion. It wasn't $2 billion. It was a lot of money. But, you know, we were bringing into our operation $8, $10 million a week. And I was, look, I had my own jet plane, I had a helicopter, I had three homes, but I also had legitimate business. So I was actually paying tax at that time too, because you can't just use that money and they're not going to be all over you, especially, you know, I don't know if you, but I had, I was arrested 18 times. I had seven indictments, two federal racketeering cases, one brought on by Giuliani, and I had a state racketeering case. I went to trial five times. I was acquitted or dismissed in every case, but so I had constant heat on me. So I had to be careful how I did things. But you know, look, I mean, I had a lot of money. I don't know how else to say it. But I'll tell you a couple of things. When I pled guilty on this whole gasoline racketeering case, I had $15 million restitution, $14.7 million, and $5 million in forfeitures, which I paid. But I had $33 million. My partner and I, the fellow that became an informant, we had $33 million in a bank in Austria. And it was a numbered account. He had half the number, I had half the number, just watching each other. And he had initially testified against me in a big case that Giuliani prosecuted me on, and I was acquitted in that case. When that happened, the government was very upset with him, was ready to throw him out of the witness protection program. He had never told him about the $33 million because I said, don't tell him about the money. I'll fight you, but that's our money. Don't tell him. Well, after they were ready to throw him out of the witness protection program, he said, wait, I didn't tell you something, and I'm going to tell you now. And he gives him the $33 million. He gives him his half, right? So the FBI goes to Austria and says, this is mafia money. We have half of the number. Give it to us. And Austria says, I don't care what money it is. You bring me the full account or you're not getting it. They didn't care if it was the FBI or anything else. So when I was negotiating my plea, they originally wanted to give me a $150 million fine and 25-year sentence. And so my lawyer said, you're never going to get this money. He's already given it up. Give up your half, and I'll negotiate the deal all the way down. So I ended up giving him that $33 million. The story gets better. You got to wait. And we worked my sentence down from 25 years to 10, which was really all I was concerned about. It was the amount of time and the 15 and $5 million in forfeitures. So I give it to them. Now I get my plea agreement, and I'm looking in the plea agreement, and I tell my lawyer, where's the $33 million? It's not in the plea agreement. So now I said to my lawyer, I said, why are you so willing to give up this Are you in on this? Did you take some of this money? And he, no. And he didn't. But, you know, you got it on the street. You don't trust anybody. So anyway, long story short, that $33 million disappeared. Didn't appear in my plea agreement. They never spoke about it again. Nothing. Disappeared. Now, if you're paying attention to some of the things that are going on today with money going everywhere, it's not, I don't know who got the money. I know I didn't at the time. Fortunately, we had other money in other places that they didn't know about it, but that $33 million, gone.
Where do you keep $1 billion in cash?
I didn't have $1 billion in cash. You know, we had a lot of cash because what happened initially, we were getting paid in cash. But then when the law changed and they made the wholesaler responsible for the money rather than the gas station, then we did a lot of wire transfers. There was a lot of both.
Attention to the point listeners, branding has never been more important. Is your brand in serious need of an upgrade? Do you have a new company and need a new brand but don't want to wait 6 months or pay a ridiculous amount to get it done? If your brand looks like everyone else's, well, guess what? You are everyone else. But Prolific, they build brands that dominate. From the first Google search to the driveway, Prolific brand design can help you be more of you, because you are the unique difference that sets you apart from all your competitors. So let's be real for a second. Your brand is either winning you customers or costing you money. Just ask some of our clients like Ken Goodrich, Ishmael Valdez, my boy Chad Peterman, and even myself. Prolific brand design is the creative pros behind some of the best home services logos, truck wraps, websites, and now email marketing campaigns. Wouldn't you love it if your email marketing open rates were 30, 40, 50% and don't go into the spam folder hell? That's how we roll at Prolific. So check them out at prolificbranddesign.com and ask for the To The Point promo, Prolific Brand Design. Be more of you. Be prolific.
All right. This gentleman in the black shirt right here, you. Yeah, you had a question.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, I really appreciate that question because I was hoping we got to that. Because, look, I'm not here in any way to glorify my former life. I'm also not here to knock any of the guys. You know, I walked away from that life, and I'll explain why. And mainly because it's an evil lifestyle. Now, I want to be clear on this. I'm not calling the guys evil. I was one of them. I just happen to be very blessed to be away from it. But the life is evil because I don't know any family of any made member of that life that hasn't been totally devastated, including my own. Now, not my wife and kids. I've been able to, you know, preserve that. But my dad did 33 years in prison. I'm sorry. My dad did 40 years in prison. My dad was released from prison at the age of 100. He was the oldest inmate in the system at the time of his release in 2017. My dad passed away at the age of 103 during a pandemic. He was the oldest living made man in America, for sure, quite possibly in the world. That's not a lifestyle conducive to a long life. So my mother passed away in 2012, 33 years without her husband. At the time of her death, I can only describe her relationship with my dad as being ugly, because she blamed him for everything that went wrong, and rightfully so. What went wrong? My sister, 27 years old, dies of an overdose of drugs. My brother, 25 years a drug addict. I can't even begin to tell you what he put the family through, what he put me through personally, just trying to keep him alive. He was always in trouble. My younger sister, the age of 40, she died. She was never mentally stable. My whole family was wiped out, the only one that survived. So I met a young girl. I was producing a movie out in South Florida. This girl was one of my dancers. It was a dance movie. And long story short, I fell in love with her. She was 20 years old, right? So I said, am I going to marry this girl? I got a major bullseye on my back. Every year they're indicting me on something else. So I'm going to marry her, bring her into this life, and go to jail forever, or maybe get killed. Because we had three wars in our family during my time. A lot of guys got killed. So I said, why am I going to do this? It's either her or the life. And I chose her. So it's not that easy. But I took the plea in a way to break away from that life. I could have went to trial again. I beat him one time. Maybe I beat him. That would be number six. Who knows? So I said, let me try to cut my losses, marry this girl. I'll do some time in prison. She'll be okay. We'll have money. I get out of prison. I'll move out of New York. I'll have parole and probation. I can't be in touch with anybody because that's a violation. Maybe after 10 or 12 years, they'll forget about me. That was my plan. It didn't work out that way because when it became very public, Life magazine wrote a big story. I was walking away. My boss, who was very close with me, took it very personal, contract on my life. My father practically disowned me. I had a lot of trouble. I ended up doing 8 years in prison, 29 months and 7 days in solitary. And, you know, I can't go through it all because I know we have a time limit here today, but that was the reason I left the life. And I'll tell you how significant it is. And yes, I became a Christian during my time in prison. My wife was a very strong woman of faith. My mother-in-law, strong woman of faith. Yes, they had a big impact on me. But it was really during my time in solitary that I came to the Lord, because I had nothing but time on my hands. And, you know, I read my Bible and I read books on every other faith, and I decided Christianity was real. That's how it worked for me. So I had a lot of trouble. The night that I got made, Halloween night, 1975, six of us walked into the room. I'm the only one alive today. The other five were all murdered. We had a war in our family at one point. Fortune magazine, 1986, huge article. 50 biggest and most wealthiest mob bosses in the country. It was half the magazine. They featured six of us. I was one of the six. And they actually had a chart with the 50 of us on there according to rank and wealth and power. I was number 18 on the list, the youngest guy on the list. And don't ask me how they make a list. It was stupid. They didn't ask for our tax returns. It just sold a lot of magazines. It was ridiculous. But it sold a lot of magazines. But here's what's not ridiculous about that chart. Out of that list of 50, some 30-odd years later, 48 of those men are dead. Number 49 is doing life in prison, and I'm the only one alive and free. So to say that I've been blessed or fortunate to walk away from a bad lifestyle and then been able to, over the past 25 years, speak all over the world and influence other people to do the same has been a blessing, and I think that's been my calling in life. So I like when we get to that part, because I don't ever want to feel that I'm glorifying the life. Look, people ask me, Michael, do you miss the life? At times I do. I had a lot of good friends there. We had a lot of good times. And you know, guys, you'll understand this. There's nothing stronger in life other than a marriage. When guys get together in a brotherhood, like I got your back, you got mine. It's just very powerful. And that's what you're told when you get into that life. And to a large degree, it happens. But of course, like anything else, it's corrupted. And on the street, corruption has severe consequences. So a lot of things happen bad in that life. I've seen a lot of things go down the wrong way. That still wouldn't have made me leave the life because I took an oath. And I felt horrible betraying my oath because I was so much a product of the life. But eventually, it broke free and I was able to do what I did. So, you know, am I the same person? Listen, I'm going to be honest with you. I have no moral issue whatsoever in stealing money from the government. And if I can do it again and get away with it, I would do it. I'm going to be honest with you. Bottom line. Because I think I'll do better with the money, especially now, than they will. Okay? But I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to get myself in trouble. I'm not going to put my wife through, you know, another 8 years of her waiting for me while I was in prison, what my kids went through, the whole bit. But morally, I don't have an issue with that. You know, you can take the boy out of Brooklyn. You can't immediately take Brooklyn out of the boy. So do I get flashbacks at times? Yes. But, you know, at least I can resist at this point for the most part. But look, you know, what could I say? I mean, I've been extremely fortunate. I'm going to be 74 years old this year. And, you know, I have no complaints in my life whatsoever.
What an incredible story of redemption.
Thank you.
Incredible story.
Appreciate it.
Everybody, Michael Franzese.
Thank you. Good. Well, thank you very much. I think, do we have a meet and greet later?
We're going to do a meet and greet with Michael right after Terry's done. So they'll both be doing them at the same time right out front. So I'll guide all you guys right after this. He's going to stick around so he can meet everybody.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Michael.
Welcome to the Point Home Services, the podcast where real contractors share real strategies. We cut through the noise and get straight to the point with the contractors that are working in the field right now. If you run a home services business and want to lead better, grow faster, and stay sharp, you're in the right place. Now, before we get started, I need you to do one thing. Only 30% of our listeners are following the show. So stop what you're doing, hit follow, and let's get to the point.